This is Higher Ed Heroes with Dr. Sebastian Kempf and Dr. Alistair Stark.
Hi, and welcome to Higher Ed Heroes, the podcast series brought to you by the Faculty of Humanities and Social Sciences here at the University of Queensland. This podcast is about all those little things that we can and should do in our university classroom, the little things that can make a big difference. Hi, my name is Seb, and I'm joined here, as always, by my friend and colleague Al.
Hi, everyone. This series is really motivated by our belief that what ultimately matters to the student experience is what happens in the classroom. In our universities, we talk a lot about course design, about teaching policy, about teaching budgets. But what we don't often get a chance to do is talk about small examples of good practice that can have a big impact.
And so in Higher Ed Heroes, we want to share those examples by having conversations with great teachers about the practices they use to bring their classroom alive and which they believe could be adapted by others to good effect.
And we want to have those conversations without using the kind of jargon that's often associated with teaching committees in higher education. So this is a buzzword-free zone. We're not going to be using words like flipped classroom, blended learning, work-integrated learning, or research-led teaching. And if we do hear those words, which we think are better suited to teaching committees, this will happen.
N-O. No!
We hope the buzzer will encourage us to talk in everyday terms about teaching practice.
And so in today's podcast, we are talking about the value and the merit of the classical lecture. And we are being joined by Dr. Andrew Phillips, who is an associate professor in the School of Political Science and International Studies here at UQ. Andrew, welcome.
Pleasure to be with you both.
Now, Andrew, these days, as we no doubt know, because we are colleagues here, there's a lot of hype around the expectation of us moving away from the traditional lecture to formats like the flipped classroom.
No.
There we had the first buzzword, the flipped classroom. So us being asked to move away from these novel ways in which the classes and lectures are supposed to happen in the direction of another one, active learning. I'm going to have to hit this again. We are being asked to move away from this, but I think in the midst of all of this, we sometimes, I think, tend to forget about the actual merit and value of the good old lecture format and how it can help students to actually learn. So, Andrew, what makes, in your opinion, what makes classical lecture still valuable today, and why should we perhaps resist following all these trends we are being asked to do?
I think one of the main things that is a selling point for me in terms of the format of the lecture is that what it does is it gives you a real opportunity to communicate your enthusiasm for the subject that you're teaching. One of the things that is a vivid recollection that I have in terms of why I have come to study international relations is that I had the privilege of being taught at Monash University many years ago by terrific people like Chris Roosmit, who's now a colleague of ours, and what really got my attention. And this is someone I didn't necessarily want to be an international relations academic or necessarily want to study that as an area, but was the ability of people like Chris to kind of convince me through the power of the medium and in particular through just the force of the performance that this was something that I could and should care about. So I think for me, one of the real selling points of the lecture is that it's performance art. Like, it gives you that opportunity to communicate that enthusiasm.
So it's a means of you being passionate about your subject that you might not get through these other more buzzword-orientated mediums.
Yes. And I think I don't want to be too censorious about the... I'm very nervous because I'm looking at this large red no button, so I'm not even sure that I'm allowed to use the phrasing of...
you can try it out.
...flipped classrooms.
Well, it's going
to... No!
I'm all for pedagogical innovation, but I think one of the issues that we need to always keep in mind with these things is I think that there is an instrumental rationale for the lecture, which is that, and this is going beyond any kind of pedagogical consideration, there's a reason that this format has been with us for at least 800 years, which is that it is a very efficient way of communicating information to a large group in a fairly effective and efficient way. I think the other element to it, though, is that, and this is where this is probably the only area where I do get a little bit concerned about some of the distinction that is being drawn between active learning.
No, no. No!
And presumably its evil twin, passive learning.
For the last time, no!
The fact that you're in a lecture and you are being part of that experience doesn't necessarily mean that if you're the student that you are a passive participant in that. And I think that we have this sort of stereotype of the lecture of, you know, people derisively refer to this idea of the sage on the stage, that it's this sort of basically someone who's there, they're communicating in a unidirectional way and the student is sitting there passively absorbing it. You don't have to adopt innovative techniques to engage the audience, and that's something that I know that you both do, that I do as well, that you can use the lecture as an opportunity to say, well, what do you think? I'm going to present you with this as a set of ideas. What would you do in this situation? Why do you think, for example, that this historical figure made this kind of decision? So I think that there are ways of combining the traditional virtues of the lecture with the need to engage students and get them actively involved in their learning process.
Yeah, I want to harken back to something you said earlier, and I can totally relate to this, the idea that somewhere in my undergraduate studies, I encountered this phenomenal lecturer. And it wasn't really what happened in the tutorials. It was this kind of immersive thing that happened in the lecture theater, which allowed my thoughts and my understanding to grow. And I could feel that, which really excited me about what I was hearing, and I think without that I would have never ended up doing what I do academically now. So that idea of inspiration, I think I strongly share. I was wondering if you could give us a bit of a sense of what good engagement in a lecture that would last, like here at UQ, for 1 hour 50 minutes, or let it be 1.5 hours, what good engagement, what quality indicators actually would look like.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing that I would say, hopefully not imperiling my continued paid employment at the University of Queensland, is the idea of the two-hour lecture format is one that even I have challenges with, in that I'm a huge fan of the lecture format. As I referenced earlier, that's the great lecturers are what inspired me to want to continue to learn. An hour and 50 minutes is a lecture. Beyonce has concerts that are shorter than an hour and 50 minutes. Much as I like to see myself as a bit of an amateur thespian, I'm not Beyonce. So I think we need to be mindful of the limitations of the medium as well as the advantages. But I think having said that, the advantage of having those longer formats is that it does make you particularly mindful of the idea of, well, if I'm just going to be talking continuously for all that time, that's going to get tiring for me, it's going to get tiring for the students. The great advantage that we have, and again, it's sort of in the spirit of defending a much maligned set of instruments, is the advantage that we have now in terms of things like PowerPoint is that you can, for example, say, all right, well, let's talk about one of the courses that I teach, terrorism and insurgency in world politics. We talk about, okay, well, what was the impact of the rise of mass media in the 1960s in the context of asymmetric warfare? What did that mean when you suddenly got these images that are coming back and having an impact on what the domestic electorate is thinking about a particular war? And what you can then do is to actually show students some of these iconic images and ask them directly and say, okay, well, what do you think? Now, the reality is that you've got a whole mix of students. Some are introverts, some are extroverts. You're always going to have that problem. And I think this is something that we all know. You have the same problem in a tutorial as well. Some students are more keen to talk than others. There is not a reliable correspondence always between enthusiasm to engage and quality of input or output. But for me, in terms of like the benchmark in terms of like what is good engagement, I don't have a particular careful metric there. It's a sense of, okay, do you get a sense from the room that there is that element of people are asking questions, they're engaging, there may even potentially be disagreement, that kind of thing.
Does anything stand out or any lecture stand out for you? We've all had that experience, and part of our motivation to talk about this was that experience where you feel like you've had a good lecture or you've had a good section in a lecture and you think, I really got to them there. It makes you feel good. You've got a spring in your step. Have you got experience or is something you do regularly that gives you that feeling that you know works?
Well, certainly my metric is that typically we have 12 lectures at UQ. I can guarantee that there'll be one lecture that I'll walk away from every semester and think that worked. Everything was just working like a nice machine. And there'll be one lecture that'll be like, that was a disaster. The no talent police are coming. I'd be in a lot of trouble. And then there'll be 10 lectures that are like, yeah, look, that was okay. Disconcertingly, I do the same thing in all 12 of those lectures. So I think that you can turn up, you can do everything you meant to do, and it's not necessarily going to land. The sense I get, though, the things that have worked in the past are And for me, the alpha and omega of good lecturing is enthusiasm. I mean, you need to, if you expect the students to be enthusiastic, you have to bring the enthusiasm to the room. And part of it, in my case, is you need to be prepared sometimes if you're covering unfamiliar historical material to make it real, even if that is at the expense of looking a bit like an idiot. I'll give you an example.
Thank you.
World War One is a subject that we cover in Poles 2, 4 and 9, International Relations of the 20th Century. One of the ways of engaging students there that I have done in the past is actually impersonating what it would be like to be a soldier on the battlefront of World War One. Now, it's a short performance because typically as soon as you go above the trenches in the age of industrial warfare, that's going to be over for you pretty quickly. Two things I've noticed. The first is that it gets students laughing, it gets them engaged, it gets over the problem of you always having a lecture that 15-20 minutes, you often get a sense that people's energy might be flagging. So you can deliberately use strategic inflection points, whether it's having a laugh, whether it's using a particularly arresting image to really kind of shake them out of their torpor. That gets them re-engaged successively throughout the lecture. The other thing that I recall from it is that in my teaching evaluations, I did get a comment of, if he really wants to sell it, he needs to turn up in the outfit next year. So if UQ will allow me to do that, that would be awesome.
You know, you gave a guest lecture in my course, and I remember that you impersonated Khrushchev taking off his shoe and hammering it on the lectern of the United Nations General Assembly, and then you held the shoe up in the honor of Comrade Khrushchev, and then you threw it all the way across the lecture theater. And I was sitting in the back there, and I was just like, wow, that's amazing. And
I never got that shoe back, though.
Yeah. But, you know,
I'm still walking around shoeless. But, it's very embarrassing.
It strikes me that there is a performative element to the idea of lecturing in you, right? So to what extent do you enter that lecture theater with thinking, okay, it's showtime? And what does that then mean?
I should also acknowledge that my family background is both my parents were in entertainment. So I'm a bit of a hack entertainer from the outset. I really enjoy performing. So that's something that I think gives me a natural enthusiasm and desire to engage in lecturing. I think, though, that there are a lot of similarities between a regular entertainment performance and lecturing. One of the clearest illustrations of this is that my feeling is always you've got, especially in that crucial first lecture, you've got about 30 seconds to really engage students, to really get their attention. You've got to start off with a big bang, because the reality is that, particularly in the age that we now live in, students have a number of commitments that they have to manage. So they're making a choice to be in that first lecture to begin with. And second, they all have laptops in front of them. So even if they are physically present in the room, it's a choice for them to be engaging you rather than engaging with puppies wearing hats on Facebook, which is always going to be fairly engaging anyway. So I think for me the main point is that, you know, and it comes back to that central message of you need to bring the enthusiasm. The thing that I would sort of also say, though, has been that the best lectures that I've experienced, and what I've tried to do is essentially throughout my career is that, you know, I've seen both of you in action, for example. You're terrifically engaging performers, but you're also both very structured in the way that you approach things. And so I think for me, the best lecturers and the ones that I've learned from the most are those that there's that big bang passion and enthusiasm, but there's also, along with the big bang passion, there's the big picture where you're continuously saying, all right, here is what we're engaging in, here is why it's important, and here is how it fits into the broad themes of the course.
So that takes me to a question. There's some great characteristics here about what you do on the stage, if you like, but what about the backroom stuff? How do you prepare? You mentioned moments where you try to be deliberately arresting at certain times in the lecture. So are you writing a script verbatim and then timing in those 20-minute breaks to say they're going to be flagging at this point, so I'll bring out something here? Or is it more organic? Do you just do it by instinct? What's the preparation like to get this done?
I certainly don't write out scripts for lectures. I'm very impressed by those that do. The reason that I don't is a very personal one, though, which is that if I have a written text in front of me, I will lose any sense of spontaneity. But then I'll also feel I can either engage as we're engaging now spontaneously, or I can read from very carefully scripted remarks. I can't oscillate between the two. So if I have a script, then I'm immediately hostage to that. What I do, which is a bit of a cheat, but I think it's something that probably a lot of us do, is that for me, PowerPoint is a form of teleprompter, is a form of autocue, saying, all right, well, what are the points that are coming up next? So in terms of the backroom stuff, the spontaneity comes fairly organically in terms of just sort of having a sense. And it's the advantage that we have. Like once you've been doing it for a while, you get a sense of, all right, well, I can feel the room's flagging a bit. What do I need to do to actually bring a bit of energy into this? The planning and the backroom stuff really for me comes into how does this series of lectures fit together? And for me, I guess that sort of comes back to the issue of, well, how do you think about this as an educational art form? The way that I think about it is that, and again, I have no science backing me up on this, but my sense is that I learn from stories. And so what I try to do at the start of the semester is to say, well, I've got 12 lectures. What's a 12-part story? And how do each of these chapters fit into each other?
That's really interesting. I've never thought about it like that. I tend to think in segments and overarching, there's a theme there, but not a story.
Yeah, but see, having observed you, Andrew, in a number of lectures, for me, what stands out, besides the great performance and this what looks like a complete free engagement with the audience, not based on a script, what stands out for me is your ability to be a storyteller. You hook it around a story and there's a narrative arch, and I was just would like to hear a bit more about that.
My interest has always been at the intersection of international history and international politics. And it's the reason for that is that I love stories. I love being entertained by stories, but I think it's an incredibly effective way of communicating key messages as well. I really come from the position that the secret to happiness in life is to have low expectations. And part of that is a stark recognition that most people will forget nearly everything that they have been taught within about 48 hours of exposure. And certainly within a week, like the half-life of most knowledge is quite frightening. So I always look at it from when I'm designing a course and thinking, what are the two or three messages that I want my students to take away from this course, one of which might stick with them a year from now? And then I think about, all right, well, how do I frame a story that will enable me to do that? So to give an example, there's a course that I teach, Terrorism and Insurgency in World Politics. And just, ASIO, if you're listening, I'm not teaching terrorism and insurgency. I'm teaching
for the non-Australian listeners, that's the Australian Intelligence Service here.
So CIA, if you're also listening, the same caveat applies. NSA, I know you're listening, so I'm just sort of taking that as a given. With a course like that, we start off with a very basic puzzle that we anchor in a story, and that puzzle is 100 years ago, roughly 80% of the time when insurgents were fighting counterinsurgents, the counterinsurgents, that is the militarily more powerful forces, won. We fast forward to the contemporary period, that ratio has pretty much reversed. So now it's insurgents that win most of the time and counterinsurgents that don't. So there you've got a puzzle. And then the entirety of the course is built around, well, how do we get to from the Boer War to the Iraq War? How do we actually account for that?
I've never thought about that before. That's really amazing. I've never thought about a single question or a single puzzle that then allows me to tell a story across a whole course. I've done it within lectures, but I've never... That's really eye-opening to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think of my lectures as chapters.
Yeah. So that leads me to a question about... Every time we do one of these, we hear these wonderful stories about what people do, but it's not always the case that everyone can do them. Is there something about your courses, because they are more historical, that are more amenable to storytelling? And is there something about your style that sits well specifically with your type of courses?
Yeah, I think I've been very lucky in the courses that I've been given are ones that fall fairly naturally within my bandwidth of interest, which... makes it very easy, that part of the job of like bringing the enthusiasm. I'm genuinely enthusiastic about this stuff to begin with. Some of the courses that I teach naturally lend themselves to that format. So we've got one, International Relations of the 20th Century, where the brief really is to tell the story of the big events of the 20th century. So that one, it's written on the label. You basically can build the course around that. The Terrorism and Insurgency course, by contrast, you could teach that any one of a number of ways. And so it was my choice to say, all right, well, how do I structure this in a way that's kind of historical as well as contemporary? And the feedback you get from students is often quite mixed. You've got some that come into it going, well, why is there all this history here? And hopefully by the end of the course, they'll say, okay, well, that kind of makes sense. Even though in situations where, and there are some courses where the job is to say, okay, there are a series of core concepts that you need to take away from this. So another course, international security. I think that there are still ways where you can structure it in ways that, even if it's not a totally coherent narrative, you can say, well, look, here's, I'm a big fan of Star Wars, so like, well, if this was a trilogy, you know, what are the three main acts within this?
That's really fascinating. I've never heard that before. That's really good.
I think the power of storytelling is certainly something that is a very good clue for anyone who might be listening here and who thinks, like, maybe there is a way for me to go forward and do this. And I think that is a nice way to round up this episode here. I mean, it's endlessly fascinating. And also have to say that this is one of the most buzzer-used episodes we've had so far. But, you know, I think that's also due to the great quality of storytelling that you have brought to this. So thanks so much, Andrew, for joining us here. And thank you guys for listening in. You can find us on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram, on iTunes, Spotify, and so on. Just search for us under Higher Ed Heroes. Thanks so much, and looking forward to having you back with us soon.